KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today, I'm very excited to have on a historian, and we've done a fair amount of discussion of the history of technology on this show, but in Professor Robert Friedel's book, Culture of Improvement, Technology and the Western Millennium, that recently came out from MIT Press, this book covers literally, its breadth is remarkable. It covers literally the history of technological innovation and the motivations behind technology improvement and what it's meant for Western society, literally from around the year 1000, and we will actually delve more deeply. The subtitle of the book, Technology in a Western Millennium, really focuses the book in a wide variety of inventions and concepts that have come to really characterize development of technology in the Western world, and it ranges everything from different forms of plows to weaponry to forms and methods of creation and methods of development. But in Robert's book, what we're focusing on is really tracing this history and trying to develop some trends and some theories with regard to how people and why people were motivated to create as they did. Professor Friedel is, in fact, a professor in the Department of History at the University of Maryland, and he's authored several other books, including Pioneer Plastic, The Making and Selling of Celluloid, Edison's Electric Light, and Zipper, An Exploration in Novelty. The book itself is so broad that this is yet another topic where I say up front that we will only be able to scratch the surface, even in an hour interview, in getting into some of these issues. As I read the book in preparation for an interview, and certainly in rereading it in the days leading up to the interview, and it is being recorded on April 17th, I was really stricken by the literally the amount of time and resources that had to go into creating a book that is in excess of 500 pages, with very few pictures, by the way. And so, although there are illustrations, which are always helpful when we discuss inventions, and indeed in the introductory remarks to the book, the list of individuals and entities that helped out in creation of the book is quite extensive. But in literally on a dust cover, the first sentence, the first question that is posed, why does technology change over time? How does it change? And what difference does it make? Those broad questions are the questions that we're going to be discussing today on Hearsay Culture with Professor Robert Friedel, author of the book, A Culture of Improvement, Technology and the Western Millennium. So hopefully I've done my job properly. And on the other end of the line is Professor Friedel. Professor, are you there? Thank you very much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Let's start off immediately with more detail. Your background and why you wrote or chose to write this book.
Well, my background is very simple in some ways. I'm a historian of technology and science, and I always have been. Even my undergraduate degree is in the history of science. So I've done a number of jobs in the field. I've worked in museums. I've worked for engineering societies. But I've taught this topic of history of technology for more than a quarter century now. And I've long been frustrated at the kind of material that was available and accessible to my students. So the first motivation was a very simple one that often motivates a professor, and that is just simply trying to get something that the student could use.
The nature of creating a book of this magnitude, really, I think, is something that we should address up front. I gave a very, cursory overview of the breadth of the history that you discussed, but perhaps you could, to give the listeners an idea, give us a more detailed breadth of where you're looking, and then some of literally the challenges that you faced in putting together a book of this breadth.
Well, I admit that when I set out to do this book, I basically started off with the kinds of things that had been important to me as a student of the history of technology, and that had become central to my own teaching of the field. And that is a sense that whatever other questions we may have about technology, about the importance of technology in the modern world, that there is a kind of, one might even call it a kind of canon of technology. That is a core set of techniques and ideas and even inventions and artifacts that has grown up over the last several centuries that everybody, whether they're European or American or Asian or whether they're rich or poor, that everyone has to somehow deal with this core, the technological core. And when I asked myself, well, how do I start off telling the story of this central core, I found myself, not because necessarily where I expected to start, but I found myself going back into the Middle Ages, into the European experience before what the historian typically referred to as modernity, and trying to ask the question of, well, okay, when do we begin to see people talking about what they do in life, things that we consider technology, but which are everything as ordinary as farming or cooking or fixing a shoe? When do they begin to talk and think about that in terms that we today can relate to as technology? And that's what pushed me back about 1,000 years.
And literally, when we're talking about going back 1,000 years, oftentimes I think today when we think about technology, we focus, certainly on Hearsay Culture, we focus a lot on technology relating to computers and the internet and what have you. But here, just to be clear, when you talk about technology, how do you define that very apparently or seemingly simple word?
Well, the definition of technology is something that the academics sometimes have fun debating, and the rest of everybody else doesn't really have too much trouble with it.
Right.
That is to say, you know technology when you see it. And what I mean by technology is basically the set of practices by which we go about doing the practical things of everyday life. Now, that's not very sophisticated, and it's not a definition that would withstand very tough questioning, I suppose. But in some ways, the easiest way to define technology is to say what it isn't, which is to say, if I go about something as a purely organic process, whether it be eating or courtship or something like that, then I won't call that technology. Or if it's something that is for purely intellectual purposes, something that I would call science, then that's not technology. But there's not much else that I wouldn't arguably include within the technological realm besides those things. So it's basically how we do things, the thing that we want to do, typically with some close relationship with the material world. That is to say, there are typically artifacts or instruments or devices or machines, and this is how we go about doing it.
And it is, you're absolutely right to point out that academics often have fun with these points that would otherwise seem self-evident. So a fair point, and contextualizing it further, perhaps I'll ask you this question. And literally, and to start off with this more detailed discussion of the book, what do you mean by the title, A Culture of Improvement?
Well, I think that's fairly easy to explain, but if you'll allow me to permit why I wanted to put things in that term of culture of improvement.
Please.
As I explained, I wanted to talk about the past. past of technology to the extent that we could understand how we got to where we got to today in the most basic way. And as I tried to put the story together, I was a little surprised myself at the fact that a theme began to emerge. This is not something that I set out to construct, but it's something that seemed to come out of the story that I found most compelling. And the theme, which is what I tried to get at in my title, was that over the 1,000 years of Western history, by which I mean European and North American history for the most part, that I covered, I saw emerging a pattern of thought, if you will, a set of shared values, which were built around what still strikes me after thinking about it for some years as a remarkably simple and even simplistic notion. And that is that people in the West clearly began to accept the idea and to work on the idea that individuals could do tasks better than they have been done before. That is to say, any kind of task, whether I'm baking a cake or raising a child or leading an army, I can think of that task as something that I am not bound to do in the same old way that I've done in the past, but I can conceivably do it in some way that will be better for my purposes. And this belief, which I honestly believe has its origins in a basic human psychology, is something that every culture, I think, has some exposure to, but somehow through the history of the West, this particular idea of improvement gained a greater purchase, a greater centrality in the cultural values. It was able to overcome competing and even contradictory values and inclinations far more effectively in the West than it was elsewhere. Just the very simple idea that you can take anything that you do or any device that you're making or working with, and you can conceive of it being better than it currently is.
It's a fascinating point, and I think it raises a question that I think we can address here as we talk about the scope of your book. But did you determine or did you see any explanations for why that was the case in the Western world, using that term loosely? And what theories do you have, or did you develop any theories that suggest why that developed in the first place?
Well, that is a complicated question, and it's not one that I believe that I've dealt with very comprehensively in my book at all. I wanted to raise the question and to suggest some elements of an answer. It would be foolish for me not to at least give it a try, but I will be the first to admit that the answers that I have are somewhat incomplete.
Fair enough.
Part of a thesis that I attempted to develop in the book was that in the West, the normal process of whereby people, regardless of where they are in the world, may experiment with an improvement and may do something a little bit better here and there. In the West, for reasons that I'll get to in a moment, these improvements that were in ordinary life are very contingent. They're very ephemeral. They're things that I do now and that I might forget about, or they're things that I will do and I'll try out and I'll put it on a shelf, or I'll use it for my own benefit, but no one else will ever benefit from it just simply because I don't tell them. Any of these things, which are, I think, happen all the time everywhere in a very ordinary way, in the West, we began to create mechanisms by which we do what I call, for lack of a better term, we capture the improvements. That is to say, we take the notion or the inclination to do something better, and somehow we make it less ephemeral. We make it more permanent. We make it more accessible. And that comes about in Western culture from the late Middle Ages onward, when we see people, for example, we see people creating communities of practice, whether they be guilds or some other forms of legal or quasi-legal association, whereby people trade secrets or they simply develop standards or ways of doing things. We see in the late Middle Ages the creation of the first patents, the first very explicit, very public statement that says, this is an invention, and we're going to reward you with property rights for that invention because we think it's valuable, and we're going to publish that. We get a host of other mechanisms by which people begin to publish material. They begin to put down in the books and in the treatises and in the pamphlets their descriptions about how they do things, about how a machine might be constructed and the like. So, and each of these elements, the printing of technical material, the guilds and the associations and the patents, each one of those elements has their own history and their own set of origin, but cumulatively they mean that by the time we get to what we might call the edge of modernity, the 14th, the 15th, and the 16th centuries, the Europeans are equipped now to take whatever inventions and new ideas and improvement people have, and to, in a sense, fix them and propagate them in ways that no other culture was able to do.
It's a fascinating area, and I appreciate the fact that it's a little bit beyond the scope of the purpose of the book, but I appreciate you developing a little bit of a theory there, which I think actually goes quite a long way in piecing together why we do what we do. This is going to sound like a silly question given the breadth of the book, because like I said, as you indicate, you're taking on literally the Western millennium. So it sounds like a funny question to ask, but you do have limitations with respect to geography, and I'm just curious. You don't discuss Asian developments, although you do reference them at times, indicating that the Asian world, in many instances, was further along than the Western world in certain areas. And I'm curious, just perhaps asking the question this way: why not discuss Asian history in more detail? And certainly, it may just mean that the book becomes even longer than it is, and perhaps unmanageable. But any thoughts as to those comparisons or why they weren't approached here?
Well, the most significant answer is the one you just hinted at.
Fair enough.
That, it would have made the book unmanageable. But there are other answers, too, that are important. One is that one of the things that made my book possible was the fact that over the last 20 or 30 years, historians of technology, primarily in Europe and America, have been working away quite diligently at trying to piece together the various elements of the technological story in the West. The attention that they've given to non-Western technologies, most importantly, but not exclusively Asian, is much more limited. So the kind of resources that one had to draw on to produce a synthetic work like this is much more limited. So that's one very practical consideration. Another, a little bit more intellectually significant, is the fact that I don't think that we can come to grips with the very important and fairly self-evident comparative question that you allude to until we have a better sense of the Western story. And I wanted to get that story down, and I wanted to get a sense of what makes that Western story distinctive and significant and a story of power, which is what it is ultimately. And I felt that I could only do that by focusing on that story and the comparative question, in particular the question of why Asia, which in many ways, many of the Asian technologies were indeed far in advance of the West, as the story begins, why does it slip behind? And why does it eventually become just basically totally overwhelmed by the technologies of the West? That's a terrific question, but it's a question that we basically need to address in turn, not necessarily alongside of a question of what makes Western technology so distinctive.
It's we're speaking to Professor Robert Friedel, University of Maryland, author of the book A Culture of Improvement, Technology in the Western Millennium on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. And indeed, Robert, you do move the ball quite far in being able to allow us to make those comparisons. I want to discuss the issue of power in a moment, but perhaps in jumping in, we can jump in a way that I'm sure you wouldn't necessarily want the reader to do, but for purposes of our radio show, I will take this liberty if you'll permit me. And let's jump into Chapter 6. Tell us about the importance of the outset of the 14th century.
The 14th century, the beginnings of what we often think of as the Renaissance, is a point at which we can begin to see, and we have concrete evidence, we can begin to see people thinking about the process of invention in very much the way that we still think about it. Now, a moment of reflection will suggest that human beings have, of course, been inventing things ever since fire and the wheel. But it's pretty clear that the way in which people thought about the process of invention, the way that they even conceived of the idea of the inventor as an individual, is basically a relatively modern creation. And it is at the outset of the 14th century that we can see this. And you can imagine my delight when I'm thinking about this in fairly general terms, and I have some ideas about some of the things that have to be tackled in talking about this period. And I run across an excerpt from a sermon from a very popular preacher in northern Italy, and this is right about the beginning of the 14th century. And in the sermon, the preacher says, inventions are important, and there will be new things. And we need to recognize that new things are a part of the world that we live in. As an illustration, the preacher goes on to say, of how important new things may appear, I, the preacher says, have spoken to the inventor of spectacles.
Amazing.
And when I read this passage, I said, oh my gosh, I've never seen anything up to this point where anybody said that they had ever talked to the inventor of anything, much less something so, on the one hand, kind of plebeian and pedestrian, but on the other hand, so fundamentally important to the improvement of everyday life. So, and that's what makes that 14th century a kind of cusp. You can begin to see the wheel turn now at a very visible speed. The century before that, the wheel is turning, and that's what I wanted to illustrate by going all the way back to the 11th century. But the wheel turns at such a rate that you can barely discern it except by stepping back from it. But here's somebody who said, I see the wheel turning now. I see invention. I speak to the inventor. I know that the world will be different. Hmm. That's a breathtakingly novel thing to happen.
You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU FM. We're going to take a very short break here before we continue discussion with Professor Robert Friedel, author of the new book, the enormously breathtaking book called The Culture of Improvement, Technology in a Western Millennium. For those of you who listen to the show regularly on KZSU, you know, and indeed for those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, which I hope you do, KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University, and relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its broad programming. Notice I am not asking you, to be absolutely clear, I am not asking you for a donation for Hearsay Culture, but Hearsay Culture, as well as all the other programs, will benefit from your donation to KZSU. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can either email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless of what you do, I do hope that you continue to keep listening to the station. So, Robert, we were discussing the 14th century before the very brief break, and I do want to probe a little bit because you mentioned earlier, and I think Hearsay Culture listeners in particular would be interested in what you discuss regarding patents. Now, of course, I recognize that you're not an attorney by training, so I don't want to get into the details of patent law, but you do note the early antecedents, indeed, you know, perhaps the first issuance of patents during this general time period. Recognizing again that you're not an attorney, I'm curious if you got the sense how many of the inventions that you discuss involve or in some way are incentivized by the existence of patents or in at least let's say government created rights with respect to inventions.
I would say that as one moves closer and closer to the 20th and 21st century, the patent, at least in Western Europe and in North America, is something that inventors take as an expected and necessary part of their environment. It's an interesting story, one that I only, I think, barely hint at as to exactly how the patent comes to take on that role of being the expected and some would argue now necessary incentive for invention. It doesn't happen in a very direct way, like most things in history. It happened by accretion, by dint of experience and familiarity. So I myself am. I'm not certain that history actually equips us very well to know how important the patent really is. That requires a kind of counterfactual thinking. That is to say, would Edison have invented the electric light if there hadn't been patent to be had?
Right.
Well, I don't know. There's part of me that suggests he might have, because there are ways of making money on things without patents. Edison himself discovered, there are ways of losing lots of money by spending them on patents.
Right, right.
So just what kind of role the patent itself plays and whether it plays a necessary role, it's actually something that I think is worth examining, on a much more specific basis. But it requires, as I said, a kind of counterfactual thinking. What would happen, or would without patents, and we don't have a lot of evidence for that.
Yeah, it's one of those areas where I think from an interdisciplinary standpoint, there is work that needs to be done, and that work is being done more and more as patent law in particular is heavily litigated, and very recently several Supreme Court decisions have brought patent law from a legal scholar standpoint to the forefront. I do want to discuss something you mentioned earlier, which I think is critical, and you mentioned that in many ways this is a history of power, and that's another area that when we discuss innovation and creation, I think can be explored in more detail. What do you mean by that statement?
Well, at the most basic level, a technology or a technological improvement is an effort to augment one's power. It may be power over nature. It may be power over other human beings. It may be power over other companies or other potential inventors. But at some level, when you seek to make a technical improvement, even though we may not articulate it very often in these terms, what we're doing is we're seeking to increase power. And I think from time to time, it's important that we step back from the process and realize that that is, in fact, what we're doing, and that there are different kinds of power, and there are different ways in which people and groups attempt to wield power through technology and through technological improvement. And that's, some people may chafe a little bit at that kind of characterization or may think that it's a kind of an accusation, but it isn't intended to be that way at all. I'm just simply stating what is in some ways pretty obvious, that is that if we're trying to make something that goes higher or faster or stronger or lasts longer or anything like that, we are arguably dealing with the realm of power. But what happens is that power over nature and power over other humans or other groups, the line between the two isn't always that easy to draw. And that's where sometimes there can be moral and ethical questions, which the creation of new technologies and the elaboration of technologies compel us to deal with, even though they're often very uncomfortable and difficult to deal with.
Again, fascinating material, and if we had a 3-hour show, as I mentioned to a number of guests, it would be probably too long for radio, but it certainly would allow us to go into greater detail. I do want to discuss with you the 16th century as well, and as a segue to that, one of the issues that you discuss repeatedly in the book is, or at least allude to, is the notion that these inventions are created in one way or another to improve the public good or to make some kind of a public gain. And I'm curious to know, as you look through this history, it's interesting that innovation occurred throughout the history you describe, even at times when we at least colloquially think were times where this kind of creativity wasn't occurring. How much of the innovation, okay, or of the inventions, or how many of the inventions that you discuss were ultimately shared with the public at large? I mean, recognizing, of course, the limitations of being able to share things with the public and without having mass communication and et cetera. Putting that issue aside, what in terms of the sharing with the public, what do you see as that, and how important an element does that play in the inventiveness that you describe?
Maybe if you could give me an example of what you're thinking of right now.
Sure. So, I'm looking at, you take something, for example, you discuss, For example, the creation of various forms of plowing or farming methods. And these methods, obviously, as you alluded to, are designed both – these methods are created to improve the process of farming, but also themselves, obviously would help improve the private life of the individual by being able to make more money or employ fewer people or what have you. And I guess what I'm getting to is the question of whether you saw throughout the tracing this history – that the motivation or the purpose of the invention itself was to improve in some way life in general for the public versus perhaps what we may see as more colloquial or private interests like literally to be able to run a more profitable business.
Well, I think one of the virtues of beginning to think about this kind of question of technological change in terms of improvement rather than in terms of invention or some of the more classic terms is that it draws our attention to the fact that typically the motivations behind any kind of technological activity are mixed, that individuals pursue their goals, improving a process, devising a new material, making a new machine. They do so for a variety of reasons, not just for one. And the motivations range all the way from the purely aesthetic, one might even say even kind of hedonistic satisfaction or pleasure that one gets from solving a thorny technical problem, coming up with an aha or eureka solution, which may make you money, it may improve the world, and it may not. But the pleasure that you get out of it doesn't depend on that. It depends on the fact that you've solved the problem, just like you completed the Sudoku puzzle in this morning's paper. That would be that's one kind of motivation that we have to always keep in mind. Another is understanding that the kinds of benefits that we may see in hindsight from a technological activity or an improvement are usually not foreseen, at least not very clearly. So we may have very short-term, very limited kind of motivation for an improved process, for example, for making something, or an improved alloy, a machine with a different set of gears or something like that. And it's only in hindsight that we look back on it and we say, aha, this is how they began to make the better things, or this is how it became much more efficient or much more economical to produce this product instead of that. But that's largely hindsight. The motivations, I'm convinced, and the more I look at it, the more I'm convinced this is true. The crucial motivations are typically very short-term motivation, very narrow and limited motivations having to do with immediate satisfaction. I'm not saying that making money and being rich is irrelevant, nor am I saying that doing good for all of humanity is necessarily irrelevant, but I'm saying that when you look at what people actually do when they're doing engineering and inventing and that sort of thing, I am struck by the great power and significance of the aesthetic and the pleasure-generating possibilities of invention and improvement.
These kinds of themes are themes that are being hotly debated, I think, right now in intellectual property law circles with respect to reconsidering the underlying assumptions about why humans create and whether those should be incorporated into intellectual property law. In fact, the guest who was on the show last week, Professor Bobby Qualls at DePaul University, is actually looking at whether copyright law in the United States, for example, should actually incorporate notions of personhood, and that the creation itself is an extension of the person, and that therefore that should be a basis for limiting rights. It's an interesting area that I think your work actually makes significant contributions to as we think about what we do with intellectual property law. I mentioned earlier, and I do want to discuss, that the 16th century, as you point out in your book, is another significant turning point, and you reference Sir Francis Bacon. So discuss that. What's the significance in tracing your history of the 16th century?
Well, it's interesting you pick up on that. There are a variety of places that one could look at in terms of what happens in at the end of the Middle Ages and at the beginning of modernity. There's a real remarkable set of changes in the expressed values of the West, and among the kinds of changes that you see are changes that are accompanied by a real opening up of literacy and the expression and dissemination of ideas. And what we see on the heels of the introduction of printing in the middle of the 15th century is a remarkable flowering, and I don't want to suggest that happened overnight, but you can see the beginning quite clearly at this period, a remarkable flowering of the possibilities of human expression in every area. Previously, the way that people expressed themselves and the way that people wrote things down and disseminated information was very much oriented around fairly limited kinds of problems and issues and concerns. The most significant of them being religion, and then, you know, to a certain extent, areas of law and politics and the like. What we see here is that the way that people do things, the way that you put metals together to make an alloy, the way that you dig a mine in order to come up with ores and valuable materials, the way that you make weapons, the way that you build ships, all of these things now become the subject of literature, of people actually writing about them. They put in illustrations. They tell you what they've done. They tell you that this is a novel way of doing things and that you ought to know about it. This is a really striking kind of departure, and this is, I think, a fundamental turning point in the West's own capacity for both generating improvement and disseminating and socializing it.
The history here, it kind of leaves me a little bit, you know, when we're talking about a history of 1,000 years, it's funny to just be jumping from century to century, where oftentimes on Hearsay Culture, we're saying, well, please describe the state of the world in 1999 versus 2002. So this is an unusual breadth that we're discussing, and I am jumping from century to century, but there's so many interesting points here I'd like to get to. You discuss Jefferson and Franklin and the idea of science as what you call the handmaiden, the technology and the growth of the United States. Your focus, you know, being in American history, I think it's interesting to note and to discuss that you mentioned the steamboat as the first major technology where the United States took an early and significant lead. Perhaps you could talk about that, and from the standpoint, obviously, the United States, you know, being a country that's new as compared to the European world. But perhaps you could discuss the steamboat and how the steamboat was a turning point for the United States.
Let me elaborate just for a second on the context here.
Sure.
Because we're so accustomed to thinking of the United States as dominant in the technological world and being overwhelming in terms of its contribution to invention, in terms of its economic power, in terms of its technological prowess. It's difficult then to mentally go back 200 years and think about this as a frontier country, the real boondocks as far as the Europeans are concerned. So that's one of the things that make the figure of Franklin so neat, because the Europeans recognize actually fairly quickly that this guy in this edge of a world place called Philadelphia has actually got some pretty interesting and creative ideas about electricity, and it's actually kind of nice to see them sitting up and paying attention. And when we get a few years later, and the steam engine has, by the beginning of the 19th century, the steam engine has been around for 100 years. It hasn't been very common. It hasn't been used for a whole lot of different things, but it's been around. Anybody who's technologically aware knows about that. So it's very striking to see that it is, nonetheless, the Americans who seize on the possibilities of the steam engine for transport with much more alacrity than the English, who sort of lead the world when it comes to steam engines, or anyone else. Now, that's not to say, as the Englishman will remind you very quickly, and a Scot or two will also remind you, that there were experiments going on, but the fact is that the kinds of things that were being done on the American rivers, on the Potomac, on the Delaware, on the Hudson, right at the beginning years of the 19th century, basically put the European experiment in the shade very quickly. And that suggests a kind of latent set of mechanical possibilities, if you will, as well as remarkably powerful incentives that are at work in the American context for invention at this level that the Europeans never even suspected. Quite reasonable that they would have expected the Americans to be copying, just as we Americans or Westerners might expect non-Europeans or Americans to be largely copiers of technology. So for the Americans to show this kind of creativity and this kind of impetus for the widespread application of advanced technology was a very startling and I think a very signal kind of thing to happen.
The history here, as we go through it, actually, on a personal note, the steamboat is a particular interest to me because I grew up in the town of Ossining in New York, which is a Hudson River town you may be familiar with. Was known as Sing Sing, but Robert Fulton's boats often docked in Ossining. And so as part of our literally in going through the Ossining public schools in our middle school, as we learned the history of the town, we actually spent some time focusing on the steamboat. So I was particularly interested personally to read that area of the book. We only have Robert, and again, on Hearsay Culture, we're speaking to Robert Friedel, professor at University of Maryland and author of the book A Culture of Improvement, Technology in the Western Millennium from MIT Press. We only have about 5 minutes or so left in the interview, unfortunately, and so I do want to jump all the way ahead to relatively modern times. After all of the inventions that you discussed, or numerous inventions, if focused on war and, including use of iron and swords and what have you. You mentioned 1937 at the inception of your chapter 24, which you titled "The Corruption of Improvement," and it caused me to think. Has improvement ever been divorced from considerations of creating the kinds of inventions that you discuss in that chapter? And you discuss really the horrific developments of the 20th century, including the development of the eugenics theory, which obviously has enormously negative ramifications for a wide variety of groups throughout history, and indeed the concept itself is largely repugnant to modern ears. But I'm curious to know, you call this chapter the corruption of improvement, and yet it seems from the history that there have been numerous other times where one could make that assertion. So I'm curious, the title of the chapter and why you saw that time period as really being that fundamental change.
Well, I struggle with this chapter quite a bit. I hope it doesn't show too badly.
I think it's fascinating. I'm just curious where that turn came in your view.
But I mean, you ask a good question. I have to explain that when you're writing about the history of technology, particularly at this level with this kind of sweep, one of the things that we historians have learned to be rather careful about is the assumption that many people carry along with them, just a perfectly ordinary kind of assumption, that the history of technology is a history of progress. That it's all a matter of things getting better and better and happier and happier and more and more. There's an element of that one cannot escape just by dint of the nature of the material condition of modern life compared to the past. But I wanted to be certain that people understood that when I talked about improvement, I was not talking about that kind of unthinking, uncritical notion of progress. I was talking about a much more limited idea, and yet an idea which is extremely powerful. And therefore, I wanted to illustrate the fact that this was this idea of improvement could be corrupted. And by corrupted, I meant that the possibilities of improvement pose a necessary moral challenge to us, which is to say, to ask ourselves, well, what do we want to have improved? Maybe there are certain things that should not be improved. Maybe there are certain things that we would pay too high a price in moral and ethical or other terms if we were to pursue their improvement. I thought the 1930s posed this puzzle and this problem with a particular starkness. This is when we begin to get the development of the techniques of military power that are used to the hilt in World War II, to the destruction of millions of lives. This is when we get the scientific pursuit of the improvement of human beings through eugenics, leading to eventually to the horrors of the Holocaust. And yet, so much of this, the kind of motivations that you see at work, are very much the same kind of motivations and the same kind of instinct that are at work throughout the history of technology and throughout the history of invention. And I wanted to show that these motivations were not themselves without the possibility of the taint of sin. And that's a very important lesson, and it's a lesson that comes up to our own day, where we can see people trying to improve things. At the end of the book, for example, I talk about the improvement I don't use a term, but it's essentially the improvement of terror. If people want to do things that we think are evil or destructive and have no moral foundation whatsoever, well, they too may nonetheless find themselves quite capable of thinking in very much the same terms of improvement that we attach to the technological triumph of our world.
We've been speaking to Professor Robert Friedel, author of the book A Culture of Improvement, Technology in the Western Millennium from MIT Press. Professor Friedel, I want to thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture and having what is a top-level but I think fascinating discussion. And I thank you for taking the time today and certainly would invite you back in the future to continue the discussion. The book is A Culture of Improvement, Technology in the Western Millennium by Professor Robert Friedel, a really remarkable book. And frankly, I would recommend this book to anyone interested in intellectual property law and really technology because, as Professor Friedel indicated, and I wholeheartedly concur, in order to really figure out where we're going with intellectual property law today and indeed what we're looking to create and what we aren't, I think understanding this history is critical. And as I read through this book, which again is really very detailed and you know in over 500 pages, quite expansive in its scope, I think I felt that I had a better idea of the kind of trends that we've seen going back in time. So it's a remarkable book, and I think quite valuable to people in the technology and IP field. I'm looking forward to talking to a number of interesting authors coming up in the next few months, including Alex Wright, the author of Glut, as well as Jonathan Zittrain, the author of The Future of the Internet, Matt Mason, Nick Carr, Tom McCraw, as well as Danny Bretznitz, who's done a very interesting study of innovation in the state, looking at several countries and how they encourage creation. Additionally, I'll have several intellectual property law scholars on the show, including Professor Tim Holbrook, as well as Professor Ned Snow, and Professor Mark Lemley from Stanford Law School, who will be on discussing more recent developments in patent law. As always, you can find the show in any number of venues, the main one being through hearsayculture.com, where you can find all of the previous shows, as well as the upcoming schedule. But that's not the only place. If you're not listening to the show live on KZSU, it can also be found on iTunes by searching Center for Internet Society in the podcast search engine, as well as through the RSS feed on the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thanks again for listening to Hearsay Culture. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I do encourage you to send me any feedback or commentary at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, that's dave@hearsayculture.com. And otherwise, I thank you for listening. I'll look forward to talking to you next week.